So good afternoon and welcome to Kadampa Center for the next in our Death and Dying series. I've forgotten what number we're on. I think we're on number 10 maybe of our year-long course. excuse me. So today's topic is going to be about estate planning, all the legal nitty-gritty that's involved with having your paperwork in order for the benefit of yourself as well as the people who love you. And as well as at the end, I'll talk just a little bit about Dharma wills and providing for your spiritual needs as well at the time of death. And so Margie Harris has very kindly come in to be our guest speaker today. She is a lawyer with, what's the name of your firm?
Ward and Smith.
Ward and Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a longtime Kadampa Center member as well. So we're very lucky to have her as part of our community to help educate us about all this paperwork and what it means and what to do.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Margie.
All right. Hi. Yeah, so Sarah introduced me. I have had a name change, so it's Margie Winfield if you're looking for me online. But anyway. So, yeah, I do estate planning and estate administration and elder law. Is this volume good? I sound really loud to myself. An elder law. So I said all that. So actually, my first time coming to Kadampa Center, I went to the old building, and Don Brown was giving a teaching on death and dying. Well, on impermanence. And I didn't really hear people talking about death anywhere. And I was just captivated by that. That was, I don't know, like 17 years ago. And anyway, so this area of law is really suitable for me. I enjoy it an awful lot. I really do. So this part that I'm going to talk about today, I was asked if I would describe something about the legal documents that come around death and dying, and I'm going to do that. So there are five or six documents that I'm going to talk about today, but I'm going to describe it in terms of 10 sort of recommendations for anyone who's thinking about their estate plan. Okay. So the first one, this one's a good one. Have a will. So, have a will. It seems obvious. Everybody knows that they should have a will, but most people don't have a will. So, if everybody feels like they should have one, and maybe they even lose sleep at night because they don't have one, why don't they have one, even though they know they should? Because they don't know why they should. Okay, so why does somebody need a will? If you don't have a will, your property at death is going to pass according to the laws of the state, which I've never seen produce a result that anybody would really want. Okay, so a will is something that supersedes the state disposition of assets at your death. It is your legal declaration of what you would like to happen with your assets when you die. So just to give you an example what that looks like, and I particularly want people with children and spouses to listen. If you have a couple who has, say, $600,000 in assets, $200,000 in a home, and $400,000 in, you know, in investment assets or something, and that person dies without a will. Let's assume that person's married and has two minor children. Without a will, the surviving spouse is going to get $600,000, and then the residuary, the what's left over after the $60,000, is going to be divided between the surviving spouse and the children. The surviving spouse will get one-third of it. The children are going to get two-thirds of the remainder after the $60,000. And that poses a number of difficulties. Most people don't want their minor children inheriting a whole bunch of money, and the state won't allow them to own it without a guardian. So if you don't have a will and you have minor children who inherit property, you've bought yourself a guardianship proceeding, which nobody really wants to deal with at that moment, you could imagine. So if you have minor children, this is why you really have to have a will. As some people seem to think, well, my family's going to get it. It's true, but you really don't want your property passing to minor children. And most people, in my experience, they want their assets to go to their surviving spouse. I mean, all of it. Like, everything that I have when I die, I want the person who survives me to have it. And that's not going to happen under the intestacy laws. So let's say you don't have children, you have a spouse, and you die without a will. Then, in same asset scenario, $200,000 in a home and $400,000 in investment assets, the surviving spouse is going to get $100,000, and one half of the remainder after that, and the remaining half is going to go to the parents, your parents that you left behind, if there are any. Anyway, those are just a couple of examples. It really doesn't work for most people. And if you have any hope to give your property to a charitable organization or anything like that, that's obviously not going to happen either. And as I go through these documents, if any questions come up, please don't feel like you have to wait to the end to ask. Yeah. Yes. That's right. I'm only talking about North Carolina law here. Okay. Okay. The second one. Yeah.
Okay, so if the husband and wife own the house together.
Yeah.
Or if you are joint on the investment accounts that you were mentioning, does that all still happen?
That's my second recommendation, which is to understand what assets pass without a will. There are some documents that will pass the way that you want them to without a will. Uh-huh.
Does the will have to go through a lawyer, or can you use one of these will software?
You can prepare your own will with document preparation software. Mm-hmm. But what you're going to miss out is on getting any advice about how assets pass, which may or may not be important in anybody's individual case. Okay. So property that passes without a will, talking about survivorship accounts, pay on death accounts, transfer on death accounts, and jointly owned property, like real property can be owned joint tenants as joint tenants. There are other ways to own it. Tenancy by the entirety, so if you're married in North Carolina and you bought property during your marriage, by default, it's going to be owned that way. And those assets, like that jointly owned real property with survivorship, which includes joint tenants with right of survivorship property and tenancy by the entirety property, will automatically be owned 100% by the survivor if it's your spouse that you own it with. If you own it with more than one person, it'll be owned by the survivors. And that is the same on your beneficiary designated accounts, life insurance, and retirement accounts. Okay. So you just have to be aware of that. If you set out a plan of disposition in your will that you spend a lot of time thinking about and whatnot, and it turns out that your principal asset, maybe your account, is going to pass to a destination that's not consistent with your will, you could be in trouble. Okay.
Oh, not in here. Are these the beneficiary designated accounts? That's an account that you have where they're going to ask you if you want to designate a beneficiary. So.
So what in addition to that? Life insurance, and you mentioned three things: beneficiary accounts, life insurance and something else.
Hello?
Retirement accounts.
Retirement accounts. Hello, hello. Is it off? Is it on? It's on. Oh, good. Okay. I hate this thing. All right. That's a little strong. I don't mean to use the word hate. Okay. Yeah, so, principally we're talking about life insurance and retirement accounts. You can also have your bank account, you know, the local bank can be owned jointly with someone, or, you know, transfer on death, pay on death. Basically, all of those things, either by law or contract, are going to pass according to whatever you've set out in the governing paperwork, okay? And, my next one is consider, oh, you won't know what that means. That's not good. I'm going to call it by, people seem to call it this. I don't call it this, but consider a revocable living trust. It's also sometimes just called a revocable trust. For the disposition of your assets at death. It also does other things for you, too. So a revocable living trust is a trust that you establish during your lifetime. It's designed to hold assets during your lifetime. You are, generally speaking, going to be the trustee of your trust, meaning you dictate how the assets are controlled and dispensed. You're the owner of all the assets of the trust. The IRS pretty much disregards the living trust, doesn't consider it as separate from you, so you're taxed the same way. It's just sort of a container that's designed to own your assets, and the benefit of it is that you can put your dispositive wishes in your living trust, and it, when you die, then your assets will pass according to the terms of your revocable trust. Instead of the executor of your will disposing of your assets, the trustee of your revocable trust is going to dispose of your assets. Why would one do that? There are lots of benefits to it, but one is to the extent you fund your revocable living trust, meaning you change the title into the revocable trust, living trust, then those assets are not going to pass through probate. And probate is what happens when you do have a will and your assets are passing by the will. You have to register it, file it with the clerk of court, who's going to oversee and make sure that all the assets are disposed of in keeping with your wishes. And they'll also make sure that all your debts are paid and all that kind of stuff. So probating is... you know, there are some fees associated with it. It's about $4 for every $1,000 of assets. It's not horrible. People talk about probate fees. It's capped at $6,000. You know, many would never even get close to that. But there's an administrative hassle. When you probate a will, you're going to have to provide periodic accountings of all your assets to the clerk of court. Everything in your will becomes a matter of public record. So your assets, the value of your assets, your beneficiaries, are all available for the public to see. And in a world of identity theft and whatnot, some people consider this an important thing to avoid. So probate avoidance. Yeah.
You're the trustee when you're alive.
Right.
Okay.
You're the trustee of it when you're alive.
Right.
So in living trust,
you can be. You can name someone else if you want
what
to.
What I'm saying is when you die, is part of your living trust that you have designated a trustee upon your death.
Yes. Okay. You'll name successors. And actually, that's going to... I'll come back to that point, because that's another application of the living trust, is it can be helpful when you become incapacitated. When you become incapacitated, the successor trustee can take over and manage your assets. Yeah.
So, can a living trust, revocable trust, replace having a will? Can you put all your assets in it virtually?
You want to put all of your assets in there, you know, as a general rule. You would also have a will with it, which is something called a pour-over will. That the pour-over will basically says, okay, so if I'm Margie Winfield and I have Margie Winfield, trustee of the Margie Winfield Revocable Trust, which is what these things can be called. Let's see. Hold on. I have this hair problem. Anything that's owned in my name individually, I need to have a will. Okay, so suppose I have a retirement account and a home and, you know, a beach house. I don't. I wish I did. You know, investment accounts, bank accounts, whatever it is I own, I'm going to title it all into the name of my revocable trust, except for maybe real property, which I'll talk about in a minute. And so when I die, that'll all be controlled. But suppose I went and bought a, you know, a Lamborghini, you know, so it's a substantial asset. It matters. And I titled it in my name. If I don't have a will that pours it over into my revocable trust at my death, then, you know, then that's going to be an intestate asset, which I want to avoid for all the reasons I discussed there. So generally speaking, yes, that's actually my next recommendation, which is to fund your revocable trust, revocable living trust. You want to get the maximum benefit of your revocable trust, put as much of your assets in there as you can. Now, the pour over will is a very simple document. It says I declare this to be my last will, and then it basically says anything else that I own goes to my revocable trust. That's why it's a pour over will. So you'd have that also.
Does that avoid then the executor fees to some degree? Because they're not doing as much?
Yeah.
You then have just trustee fees?
In your will, executors aren't necessarily paid anything. If you have a corporate executor, they're going to charge a fee. But if you name your sister to be your executor, you can provide in your will that she gets compensated or not as you wish. It's the probate fees. And, yeah, any so let's just say let's talk about three assets, a house, an investment account, and a retirement account. I put my investment account in the name of my revocable trust. It doesn't pass through probate. I have my children designated as the beneficiaries of my, life insurance, retirement accounts are complicated. Let's say life insurance policy. Okay, forget. I don't have a retirement account. I have life insurance. So I designate my life insurance proceeds to pay to my revocable trust at my death. And in my trust, I've made provisions of individual trust for each of my children. So all of that avoids probate. My house, I didn't put it in my revocable trust, and I'll tell you why. But under North Carolina law, there are no probate fees assessed on it. So it will go through probate, but it'll be a relatively the probate of the will itself becomes a deed of conveyance to my heirs. So it's real estate, sort of a special exception. You might not put your North Carolina real estate in your will, and the only reason you wouldn't is because title insurance companies, property and casualty insurance companies, and you know, banks, if you want an equity line, they may not like the fact that your trust is the owner of your property, but you're trying to deal with, you're trying to get a policy on it, or, you know, get money, borrow money against it. Okay? Yeah.
Thanks. I did a little bit of research on this, and I was thinking I might not need a living trust, because if I just have property, which you just talked about, doesn't, you know,
real property
kind of slides through probate without a whole lot a problem. And it's my understanding that IRAs, they also are not included in probate. Can you explain to me if that's correct or not?
If you have a
with beneficiaries
current
named,
properly executed beneficiary designation, it's going to pass according to that.
Okay, so those two things really are not going to get too much involved in probate, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, no, your real property is going to go through probate. It will be, your will be probated, and your property is going to pass through, it'll be listed as an asset of your estate. It will go through probate, but it's a relatively uncomplicated process there, and there won't be any fees, okay. Probate fees associated with it.
Okay.
And, you know, your retirement account will pass according to your beneficiary designation, assuming it's all proper. And, you know, my recommendations down here are going to be to check to make sure that all those things are current and done correctly.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Who decides if you're incapacitated?
Okay, well, you're jumping ahead, so...
Oh,
I can wait. Let's just... let me go through, because I like my recommendations, and so I want to go through them all, and then we'll get down here to get incapacity
sure,
later.
Sure, because you had mentioned that in living trust, and I can wait.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that, too. In fact, everybody's like one recommendation ahead of where I am. You've got this. Okay, so the next one is to have a durable power of attorney, speaking of that. Is that my next one? I think that's my next one. Okay, durable power of attorney. Okay, so a durable power of attorney is is a document you execute to name certain agents, you know, agents of your choosing to handle your affairs when you become incapacitated. Okay. The document is called durable, and durable is what you want. If you don't have a durable one, it doesn't help you because then it doesn't survive your incapacity, which is actually the moment when you want it to work for you. Okay. So, that was a change in the law because it used to be that incapacitated persons couldn't be held to their contracts. So when you became incapacitated, all of a sudden your power of attorney didn't work, so they changed the law so that it was durable at that moment. Well, some people may want to have a power of attorney even before they think of all the people here who've asked about it, and people traveling overseas, and I need to sell my car, and, you know, it happens. People might want a power of attorney. In those instances, we usually do one that's very limited for a specific purpose. But here, you're basically, the more authority you can give to your agent as a general rule, the better. But you would for sure want to get advice about that because it's a powerful document. You're allowing someone to make all sorts of, you know, all your financial and business decisions for you. Why would you want to do that? If you don't do that and you become incapacitated, then you're back to a guardianship proceeding. You have to be down there with a clerk and whatnot, and it's always better to avoid that if you can. Plus, you get to choose who your agent is, okay? In a guardianship proceeding, they're going to give preference to, say, your spouse or, you know, your loyal daughter or whatever, but what if you have, like, a ne'er-do-well daughter, you know, and she, you know, so it's good to have your agent selected, and you can provide for the succession of agents too. Like a lot of people say, I would like my spouse to be my agent when I'm incapacitated, and then, you know, this next person, and then this next person. So basically, when we draft these things, we draft them as broadly as possible because, you know, if you're incapacitated, you don't want to constrain your agent. You want them to be able to do what they need to do, including you can include gifting provisions, which allows your agent to give away your property, which can be a helpful thing when you're planning for long-term care or maybe if you are extremely fortunate and have an estate tax liability problem. Okay. Okay, so that's a durable power of attorney. Have a health care power of attorney. Same thing. Although a durable power of attorney can be operative right at the moment you sign it, which is our bias, we generally do it that way. Healthcare power of attorneys only are effective when you become incapacitated. And, about who determines whether you're incompetent, you can define that in your durable power of attorney. I don't know what a form document would say about this, but ours generally, you know, people have their different preferences with this. Some of them can be written. I mean, if you really don't want your spouse to have to run around and chase down new doctors and get them to sign a piece of paper saying you're incapacitated, you could say my agent has the authority to determine if I'm incapacitated, which is can be very helpful, kind thing to do if you have a... And then people are, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm really giving my agent a lot of authority. Well, if you don't trust them, like, through and through, they shouldn't be your agent anyway, right? And that's just my thought on it. But these are documents that you can prepare according to what you're comfortable with and what your goals are. All right, so that's it on that. This is a matter of contract here, who determines you're incapacitated here. This is in the opinion of your physician, you're incapacitated. And just yesterday we had to run a healthcare power of attorney over to Wake County Hospice because somebody was checking in and needed one to give in there, you know. So when that person becomes incapacitated, then his agent is going to be able, mentally incapacitated, his agent's going to be able to make all his healthcare decisions for him. We generally, you can make this more or less broad. If you have some sort of religious objection to a certain practice, I think Jehovah's Witnesses won't take blood transfusions or something like that. You can incorporate that into your document. So that's the healthcare power of attorney.
So I just want to be clear. These are two separate documents.
Yes.
Okay. So one does not. So a durable power of attorney is healthcare power of attorney is not subsumed or cannot be subsumed into a durable power of attorney.
Well,
in terms of making decisions about your care when you are incapacitated.
Yeah. If you read the documents, it'll be. They'll sort of list the areas in which the agent is authorized to make decisions, and this one describes basically a large array of business and financial decisions, and this is all healthcare ones. And the way we prepare our documents, they'll cross-reference and say, you know, this is not meant to supersede that document or anything like that. They're regarded as independent documents. You have to be careful about that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
There are a lot of moving parts here. The healthcare agent that you name here, so suppose you don't have one. That means that when you become incapacitated and need someone to make healthcare decisions, you know, and maybe you need that done right now, then you're back down at court in a guardianship proceeding getting someone named, okay? And on that score, I would like to mention you might be thinking for yourself or your spouse about what kind of what kind of agency documents you want in place. But it's also really helpful if you have kids going off to college. You might not have thought about it, but they're over 18. They're adults now. If something happens to them when they're at school, you know, you don't have the authority to make decisions for them anymore. So it we will recommend for people that have kids going off to college that they have their children execute agency documents, so that they can make decisions for them if something happens. If the kid's in a car accident and somebody needs to make a decision, you know, then you get to be that person, which is something most parents want, especially there's just a general trend that kids are maturing later, and I think that's maybe because people are going to school longer or whatnot. I mean, it was like not too long ago in your mid-20s, you were done with school and married. That's not the case anymore, and so there needs to be a decision maker for these people.
For the child, would you call that an
agent? This actually, the healthcare power of attorney, like the advance directive that we'll talk about now, they're both advance directives. They're both saying, right now, this is what I want in terms of my healthcare and my final wishes. I'm calling them agency documents because. And that's just what I'm calling them. I don't know if that's the official term. But you're naming agents to make decisions for you when you're incapacitated. Okay. Also, your college-age kids, you know, if they're married, obviously their spouse is going to be their agent. But in addition to those kids, you might think about if you have parents who are, you know, older and maybe at risk of incapacity, which is pretty much any older person anymore. You might want to have this document there, because if that person needs to do some long-term care planning, by which I mean, you know, unless they have long-term care insurance in place, Medicaid planning, it will be very helpful to you at that moment to be able to have a well-executed, durable power of attorney with very broad gifting authority that allows you to give away their assets. That sounds bad. Not in the way to take advantage of anyone, but just to restructure the ownership of their assets so that everything works in the ideal way for that person, right? I'm not trying to help children take advantage of their parents, but sometimes it is very helpful to have that sort of document when you want to take care of mom or dad.
Mm-hmm. What happens if a child who's over 18 is in a bad accident and you don't have an HCPOA?
You'll have to go to a guardianship proceeding if you need, you know, if you would like to make decisions for that child.
What if it's in another state?
I would assume it would be the same thing.
So it could be time involved, like the hospital can't call you and say, what should we do? I'm just wondering, like, if you get a call from the hospital, your daughter's been in an accident and we need to know if you want to A or B, they can't do that?
They might do that. I'm not sure what they're going to do. But from a legal perspective, the adult child, the 18-year-old, nobody, unless they have executed a document, is in a legal position to make decisions for them.
Okay.
So I don't know how a hospital handles that situation. I mean, if they're looking at an 18-year-old kid and a decision needs to be made right now, I can't say they're not going to call mom and dad even without one of these. But you can't count on it, and so it's a good thing to – I mean, you just can't count on it.
Because in college, I think you sign a form saying that if you're not there,
the
representative of the college can do that.
I'm not sure what documents they have at college, but you would want to look at them. You understand what the issue is, right?
Yes.
Okay. That's the thing. Okay. I'm going to run through my notes over there, make sure I'm not missing something, but I think we're covering it. I call these advanced directives, but other people call them living wills. I guess I should call them what everybody else does, but I don't even know what that means, living will. But an advanced directive seems to be really descriptive. This is when you're saying right now, and you're in full health and capacity, that when and if you get to the moment where you're at the end of your life and there's no more hope, you know, that you want, you have certain choices to make at this moment. Generally speaking, you're talking about withdrawing or not implementing life-sustaining measures at that moment. There is an option on the state statutory form that allows you to direct in advance that you want every single possible thing done for you, but I've never seen anybody select that. Okay. Usually people are taking advantage of this to make sure that they're not receiving artificial hydration or nutrition that's going to prolong the time of death. And they're, you know, the advance directive is only going to apply in three situations, and they're all those times when there is no hope. When you're in the advanced stages of senility or, you know, incapacity, and you're never going to get your faculties back, and you're in, you know, you're starting to lose bodily function, then your advance directive can, you know, be called upon to let that process happen at that moment. Same if you're terminal with cancer. Maybe you do have faculties, but you're doped up and you can't make a decision. Then, you know, maybe it operates at that moment too. Mm-hmm. And there's another one.
But can't that be rolled into the healthcare proxy?
The healthcare directive, well, yeah. No, they're not rolled in. They're separate documents, and they're going to look for separate documents in the hospital. This is very different. And the way this relates to your healthcare power of attorney is you can make the choice that you would like to have your advance directive supersede anything that the healthcare power of attorney, the healthcare agent might say, or you can say that you want your healthcare agent to supersede your advance directive, you know, based on the circumstances at the time. So, so these two things do have to be looked at together. And people usually want their healthcare agent to make the final decision. In this world, the chances that your attending physician is going to know you at all are slim, and so people like to give that decision to their spouse or, you know, their close people, their agent, who they've named. Or some people don't really want to burden their agent with making that decision. I mean, maybe nobody wants to make their daughter decide when to turn off life support. So, but you have that choice.
But when you elect the healthcare power of attorney, you're oftentimes putting into that document, not just electing the person, your desires and wishes about how you...
You do.
So the power of attorney has that information. So I'm just wondering why this isn't just, you know, a duplication.
It's not a duplication because physicians are going to want to see this before they cut off life support. It's all controlled by statute, and there are lots of liability issues involved. So doctors want to see these documents. And the healthcare agent, you can give them authority to make decisions about life prolonging treatment. If you do, there'll be a little separate in our documents. I can't talk about form documents, but there'll be a separate paragraph that describes that. But if you, but you might not give them that power. I mean, it's up to you. So it's really not the same document at all. They can overlap. So you would need both of them. And I would also say that practically speaking, if you're getting this one, this one's really easy to get because it's, you know, actually the way we do it, all of these documents here, you know, come with the price of getting one of these. So, and probably if you're inputting software, I don't know, I haven't done it, the information that you put in for this will probably generate one of these also.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and about that, one more thing. All of these things are creatures of statute. So if you've come from another state and you have one of these documents, you might want to think about getting a new set, especially these ones, because, well, I mean, just because of the issues involved there. Here, too, if you don't have one that's executed that meets our statutory requirements, which actually I think would be unusual, but if that happened, then you might have your agent may have a hard time transacting your business here when you need them to do it. And you want to make sure it's right before you become incapacitated, because after that you can't do it anymore.
I just want to address the living will or advance directive and the importance of each of us taking the responsibility to have that, because I've, from my own experience, sometimes the designated agent for the healthcare POA has one idea, and the children, for example, have another idea. But if, in this case, the advance directive, I mean, cut through it all,
mm-hmm.
and so there was no question about what that, you know, the person in the coma wanted. So it really does make a difference.
Yeah, it does. They really are. This is any old healthcare decision, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, when my guy in hospice, you know, if his agent thinks that his palliative care needs to be changed, then that happens here. That's a sort of a different decision than, okay, we're done, you know. Okay.
Margie, are
uh-huh.
you familiar with the Five Wishes document?
I am. Mm-hmm. I'm not very familiar with them, but I know what that is. Mm-hmm.
It has both of those in it. It has the advance directive and it has the healthcare power of attorney. And I did, just so people know, I did call them and ask them if the healthcare power of attorney was valid in North Carolina, and they told me it was.
Yeah, then there's another one, Most, is that, do you know that name? Anyway, there are other options that the state determines what the form has, what has to be in your document for it to be effective here. And it offers a statutory form so that you, I would never recommend it, but you could take the statutory form and create your own documents. They're not exclusive, so you can come up with something else as long as it meets the statutory requisites. And actually, there's a lot of dissatisfaction in the state about these documents right now. Children are taking advantage of their parents under these documents. These documents aren't providing support for, at the end of life the way one would hope. You want those wheels greased, and there's a lot of, sometimes it doesn't work the way you'd want to hope. So actually these things I know are going to be looked at. I'm on the subcommittee that's going to change the law on this, so that's good. The other thing is lawyers are meeting, generally speaking, with healthy people who are trying to make decisions for down the road. That's different than being the person who's actually in hospice or in the ICU and whatnot, and the doctors that are there too. So that's it's sort of taking the input from that end, from the other side of it, to help make these work better. Oh, there's one more thing I wanted to say about that. If you're interested in researching this stuff a little bit, Baptist Hospital in Winston-Salem, there are like three university-type hospitals or something over there. I don't even know what they all are. I'm not a very good North Carolinian, I guess. But anyway, they're sort of their own initiative coming up with their own documents that they think are going to work better in the hospital context, and they're very different from what we come up with. So, they say that I don't find them very helpful myself, but they say that they're easier for people to understand. But anyway, if you want to, you could research that if you want over there. Maybe Wake Forest University Healthcare Power of Attorney would come up with the document. I don't know. Okay. Bowman, yeah, that one. Bowman Gray? Yeah. Bowman Gray. That's right. It is Bowman Gray.
Yeah,
that one.
The money needed to have it to designate a different way of naming it to keep the money stream going.
Yeah, I understand. Okay. Yeah.
I guess my question is, if you were traveling abroad, would any of these documents have effect?
Well, maybe not, right? Because you have them here and... But if you're traveling abroad, I don't know that they're necessarily looking for anything like this anyway. You would just sort of be at the mercy of whatever the applicable regime was where you were, I think.
Can I say something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. You probably can't, obviously if it's an immediate accident or crisis, you can't do anything about it. But one of the things, I had a couple of friends that ended up very seriously ill abroad, and they had someone here in the United States that was, and within their durable power of attorney, and I don't know if it's a living trust, they had resources, so this person could use resources to get to the country.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they showed up, the medical providers there were really happy to somebody.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, they didn't fight it at all. So
right.
I guess if you're going to be traveling abroad, I don't know how it happened. I don't know how this person did it, but it really probably saved his life.
Yeah.
Does that?
Yeah, that makes sense. It does.
I don't know how you would designate it or where, but it was pretty seamless. The person got there in like 36 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, so suppose you have like a North Carolina healthcare power of attorney and you're in India. I mean, it doesn't have any legal effect over there. The only thing this guarantees is that it will be effective in the state of North Carolina, but it doesn't hurt to have this document. And if you had a New Jersey healthcare power of attorney and you were down here, I can't say that they won't respect that in the hospital. They might. But this is the only thing that's guaranteed. I wanted to say one more thing. Oh, back up to this, okay? So if you've put all your assets in a living trust and you've named a successor trustee to take over when you become incapacitated, then that person can pretty much do many of these things. You would normally have both of those things. And actually, this person and this agent and your fiduciary under this document are usually going to be the same people. But that's another advantage of having a living trust. And banks tend to prefer to see trustees under a living trust more than they don't like this as much as that. I mean, they have to respect this, but actually, even though it's not required by law and it's really frustrating, financial institutions will often require that this document be recorded with the Register of Deeds before they'll acknowledge it, which is sort of a pain. This trustee under this document is not going to have that problem. That's going to be one of the issues we'll work on because that it's just not required by law, but banks require it sometimes. So. And, yeah, okay. So I don't want to get down into the weeds on that. How many is this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, so we just have two more. Seemed like there was something I wanted to say about this. But anyway, all right. So review your beneficiary designated accounts. I'm really sloppy writing. My handwriting's no better. Okay, so these are your assets that are going to pass at death according to what you indicate on your beneficiary designations. Again, that's generally speaking your life insurance proceeds, retirement accounts too, but I'm going to talk about those separately down here. Transfer on death accounts and jointly held property, that kind of stuff. You just have to make sure that your beneficiary designations are consistent with your retirement with your estate plan. So and that includes your retirement assets too. There was a woman who a smart professional lady decided to get an estate plan together. She had minor children. She was divorced. And she put together a will and whatnot and, was very thoughtful about it. But it turned out most of her assets were in her retirement account, which she had designated to go to her children who were minors. So she ended up, she died. The children ended up in a guardianship proceeding, and the father would be the natural person to be the guardian of those assets, but he couldn't show up because he was in jail. So luckily they had someone else. The woman's brother was able to be the guardian for the kids, but it would have been really nice to avoid all of that. Plus, these assets, even if they have a guardian there, are going to pass to those kids when they turn 18, which is not what you want. So lots of reasons to make sure that you don't designate directly to your minor children. With these assets, generally speaking, you can direct them to, if you have a revocable trust or a trust created under your will, you can direct them to that and specify that. You know, in your trust, you might say, you know, I direct those assets to a trust for, you know, this or that child to be held in trust until they're, pick the age, 25, 35. You know, you can design that. But everybody pretty much doesn't want their 18-year-old to have a like few hundred thousand dollars or however much. And then retirement accounts, I just accept those out a little bit because those have to be handled specially. If you because there are tax consequences to it, these are income tax deferred accounts. So you would really want to consult with someone before you did anything with retirement accounts and trusts particularly. Okay, so that's something you have to be careful about. The person who inherits your IRA gets stretch out treatment on the income tax. That's what you don't want to lose that. Okay, then taxes. So there's a $5.34 million exemption from estate tax now, and that's per person. And so couples have essentially like $10.68 million that they can pass at their death without any concern about estate tax. Some people actually have this problem. Most of the people I deal with, they don't have this problem anymore. They used to. I mean, they bumped up. This estate tax exemption was possibly going to go away and return to $1 million at the end of 2012, but they didn't do that. So less tax planning for me, I guess. Anyway, if you have an estate that's kind of in that realm, you're going to want to be talking to an attorney no matter what, for lots of different reasons. So I think, does anybody have any questions about these documents? Mm-hmm.
Under the healthcare power of attorney, does there need to be a special designation in North Carolina for mental health decisions with regard to mental health, like someone being evaluated by a psychiatrist or needing treatment within a mental health facility or,
It depends on how you've crafted your document. A very broadly drafted one would include decisions, like that for evaluation and whatnot. But again, this is never going to apply or be effective until someone's been determined to be incompetent.
That's exactly where I've seen it come in because,
who can. Well, usually it's the physician that's working, or two certified physicians, or a certified statement from two physicians is usual.
But I thought you said you could designate in the
durable power of attorney. Usually this is going to be a doctor who's making this determination.
So there's a difference in who determines between the durable power and the healthcare power.
Yes, they are. They're different documents. You have a lot more freedom with this one because this is specially regulated by the government.
I have a question about someone who may live in more than one state during the course of a 12-month calendar year.
Oh, that's a great question.
What happens? I mean, it seems like the durable power of attorney, the living trust, all that seems to be, mute, but the health care power of attorney, if you are hospitalized in different states, you're saying you needed to designate someone in each of those states?
It would just be up to you. If someone had a lot of resources to put at their planning, they might do something like have specially drafted agency documents in each state that specifically cross-reference the other documents in the other states and said that the one doesn't supersede the other, and then would name agents in their respective states because they'd be physically present and able to be helpful. I mean, that would be that would be one way to handle it. The other one would be just to execute one set of documents and, you know, hope that they work the way that you would like, or maybe have an attorney look at the documents created in the other state, determine whether those documents meet the requirements of this state, and maybe that would give you some assurance that they would be implemented the way you wanted them to. But on the question of property, that's another advantage of having a revocable living trust. If you, say, own property in Maine and you live here in North Carolina, if you that's sort of complicated. You could put that property in an LLC, then you could have the revocable living trust own the LLC interests, and then you wouldn't have to do probate in that state. So it's nice not to have to do probate in more than one spot. It's nice if you can avoid it altogether. But
you said that these documents are valuable in North Carolina. We had all these documents for my husband, and when he was terminally ill, he was in three different hospitals. None of them accepted it. We had to give one of these documents to the hospital. They want to have their own filled out. So every single one, we had to fill it out again, because Duke said they don't care what Wake says, and Wake says they didn't care what the other says. So how do you do that? You have a document like this, and then you're the only one left, or your family is far away. How do you handle that? I mean, what is the hospital going to accept then?
The hospital should accept any validly executed, statutorily compliant healthcare power of attorney. But I think that's one of the issues about these documents, because the different hospitals will have their different opinions about, I mean, they have opinions about how these things should read based on their practical experience dealing with people who are sick. And all I can say is that if it was validly executed according to the requirements of the statute, they should have honored those documents.
Margie, I don't understand that. If it's actually a document that meets the state's requirements, so does that not make it, is it a legal document or is it not a legal document?
If it's executed and it complies with the statute, and it's properly executed, it's a legal document.
So the hospital has, I don't understand from the conversation, does the hospital have the right to deny what is in this legal document?
Not that I'm aware of. I think they should respect it. I don't know what to say. That's sort of beyond, I don't work in the healthcare industry, so I don't really know what that decision-making process is within the hospitals. There are attorneys who do that. Oh, is that what it was? Yeah.
That's different than leaving a document that had been executed.
Okay, yeah. That would be different.
Can you repeat it for the people?
Oh, well, it...
What she said.
Okay, Venerable... Kondo said that maybe Marina's question was that would a document executed at Wake have authority at Duke? No, it wouldn't. Not necessarily, no.
That's actually, my question was, we had a document like this, yeah? It was done with a lawyer, and then we wanted to give it to the hospital.
Yeah, that should not have happened.
They wanted to have filled out their own. And every single hospital wanted that. They had their own papers, the same as the living will.
Yeah.
Once it was delivered, once you got in, we had to do the living will all over again.
Yeah, that's too bad. Was your husband competent and able to execute those documents? So that's a relief. That shouldn't happen. And also, you know, like Wells Fargo might, you know, if I went and took a... I mean, I'm just pulling a name out. I'm not saying, but if I took my power of attorney that's validly executed and I'm saying, well, I would like to transfer this money from this account, they're like, well, you got to record that thing. I have researched it. No, you don't have to record it. There is no recording requirement, but practically speaking, if you want your durable power of attorney to have, you know, to work, you're going to have to record that thing. Why would you want to avoid that? Because once you record it, it's a pain to change it. The good things, these things, all of these documents can be changed by you at any point while you're alive and competent. Not so if you've recorded your, then you have to, like, register a new one, and it's a pain.
I would just like to attest to the value of doing all of this. My father was very thorough prior to his death and making sure that all his financial and business accounts were in order, and he did all of this as well as giving my brother and me a list of all of the important contacts, his insurance agent, his attorney, his doctor, his financial advisor, et cetera, et cetera. And it made that whole process so easy for us. There were still snags, but we didn't have any problems that I've heard other people have had. So I really appreciate his diligence and attention.
Yeah, that when I work with clients and they walk out and they've signed their documents, I'm so happy for what they've done, because they've really it is a gift, because you know I also do the estate administration side, which is the probate business, and it's hard. I mean, it's death. It's families are dealing with that, and they don't want to be dealing with a bunch of this.
Thank you.
Before I forget, your healthcare agent under statute if you include that power in their document, can determine what is to be done with your remains. So you can request to be cremated in your will and whatnot, in which case your executor would make that decision, but usually people leave it to their healthcare agent. Okay.
I wasn't clear. Did you say that it's good or bad to record DPOA or HCPOA or living will?
You don't record these.
Flexibility.
Huh? Okay. These aren't recorded. The durable power of attorney doesn't, by law, have to be recorded. I could execute one right now and sign it, and then whoever I named it, designated as my agent, should have all authority to do everything I said right then. But as a practical matter, financial institutions are requesting to see that the document has been recorded. What the law does say is that when the principal, the one who executed the document, becomes incapacitated, at that moment, it does have to be recorded for it to work, right? Because that's a safety feature for the incapacitated principal. So it becomes a matter of public record and everybody can see. But what some banks have been doing is requiring that an otherwise validly executed power of attorney by a competent principal it's not required by law to be recorded, but it should confer the authority contained in the document.
So if you do record it and you want to change it, what happens?
Well, then you have to execute a new one. You have to give notice to your named agents, and you have to go record the new one to supersede the last one. I mean, it's not an insurmountable problem, but because it's more of a burden than not recording it, we generally don't record until until the principal becomes incapacitated, which is when the law requires that it be recorded. At the Register of Deeds.
Where is it? It's being recorded at the Register of Deeds.
Mm-hmm.
In the county where you live?
Yeah.
Okay.
And probably any county where you own property. So if you own a beach house, you want to do that also.
What if someone wants to die at home? Is that possible?
I don't know. That's more of a question of what the resources are available and what the level of care is that is needed. It's great to die at home, and if people plan well, you know, if they plan and they have the resources, and they can line up the care that they're going to need, they can do that. Yeah. I keep hearing how wonderful hospice is and how many I don't even know everything that they do, but they do a lot more than you think they do, including coming to see people in their homes.
Margie, I think that can be part of the healthcare power of attorney, that as part, you know.
Oh, to express, to give the authority that someone be cared for in their home?
Yes.
I'm sure, as broadly as we draft it, I'm sure that could be read to be included. The substitute decision maker could make that decision, I would think. I hope maybe I missed what the question was, but.
And also, wouldn't that be under your advance directive or your living will?
No, the advance directive.
Okay.
Well, that's it. Just is talking about removing life-sustaining treatment. So if you're at home, then the doctor's not feeling like he has to supply that to you. But if you're in a hospital bed at the hospital, he's going to feel like maybe I need to be doing this, and you want to stop it if that's your wish.
I'll take it down about 20 notches. Just a real base, simple, tiny question.
Yeah.
If you have nothing.
Uh-huh.
So most of these things don't relate, but except for the will. And so just thinking generally, since my daughter's a minor, what about just my household things? Where do they go if I died? Because she can't just take them somewhere, you know. What happens to your stuff?
I was just looking at that. I think. Shoot, Jill. I think that there's some exception for tangible personal property that doesn't have great value. Like, you know, I mean, it's not a Chagall painting on your wall. It's the stuff everybody has. I think that can go, but I would have to look at that specifically. I don't think that has to be transferred. Well, your daughter would get it anyway, and if it doesn't have, I don't know what the limit is on guardianship, what kind of property can pass to her. If it's your car, you're going to have a guardianship proceeding. If it's your teapot, that's not going to rise to that level. It would be good probably. Everybody really should have a will.
Who makes that decision if you don't have a will?
Well, I mean, you would want a will anyway to name a guardian for Marie.
Before I had a will, I used to have one, and then it was because I was separated. It's no longer valid. So if I didn't have one, I've always wondered who comes in and decides.
Dave would decide.
Oh, Dave would do that.
Probably as your dad, as her dad, what would happen. So that's another reason to have a will, is to name guardians for minor children, even if you don't have property that you're worried about.
If a couple is married and they have a will and then they separate or divorce, is that will no longer valid even if they both agree that it's still okay?
That's a good question. There is a statutory provision that says when people, I don't know if it's when they're legally separated or when they're divorced, that carves the estranged spouse out of, or the ex-spouse out of, the existing will. And I don't know if you'd have to do something special to prevent that from operating. I don't know. Huh? You know about that?
Yeah.
Okay. You rip it.
I mean, she said you just rip it.
Yeah. That's true. You can destroy your will, but if you want to keep your will, I think the question was, what if you still wanted that will to be effective? Then I'm not sure if you have to do something. I would assume you'd have to do something affirmative, like in your separation document, saying, you know, that will executed, or those wills executed by us on this date, we want those to still continue. Something. I don't know. I'm glad I don't do domestic law. Yeah.
In that case, when you are married and then you separate, yeah, that each of them is a copy of the will. If you rip it apart, the other one is still available and fully valuable. I mean, you have to rip every single one apart, every copy, to make it invalid.
We weren't legally married.
Okay. A will in someone else's possession. Well, if you would just have to... you know, ideally you would execute a new will that is dated later than that, that says this will supersedes any will that I have created before. That would be the best way to do it.
How? Where do you keep a will? Because I was told, for example, if your executrix is a beneficiary of the will, she should not have a copy of it. So where do you keep a will that that person has easy access? Because the lawyers don't keep wills anymore. They don't keep copies.
We do.
You do?
Yeah.
Yeah, they told me they don't keep it because you might have a later will and they don't know about it and then you're going to trouble. So.
You know, people are going to handle it differently. I guess we keep them in a will vault that's fire safe. Oh, really? Well, that's good. Yeah, that's great news.
Yeah, I asked about that because if you're not in a relationship and you're single, there was this kind of, not fear, but there was this moment of uncomfortableness like, well, how would I tell anybody where my stuff is? Who would I tell? And they said there's a whole, the Death and Dying course has a file cabinet that's locked and no access, and that we can keep our stuff there, our wishes. So if we die, or if we're incapacitated, we can tell people, these are the prayers I want, these are the mantras I want.
I think Sarah's going to talk about that shortly. One thing I have to clarify, your ex is going to be the guardian of Maria if he survives you, no matter what you say. But it's still helpful to have a will. If he, you know, if he died the day before you, the person that you named to be her guardian after him would be the one. So.
So I'm a single guy, and I have no will right now, but if I got a will today and 5 years from now I wanted to change it, how difficult is it to change it? I mean, is it sort of a, you know, I'll give you a deal because we're just changing some names here, or is it start the whole process over again every single time?
Well, if it's, you know, it would be a judgment, you know, the attorney helping you with it, if you had an attorney helping you with it, would have to look and see how extensive. I mean, basically you'd be, ultimately you're looking at drafting time by the attorney and a lot of proofing, which is so important, I can't tell you. That attorney would have to make a judgment whether, you know, they might have a set price for doing a codicil, which is going to be less than doing a whole new set of documents. And if he or she thinks that it can be done, you know, at that range, that's what it'll be. Yeah, generally speaking, if it's a minor change, like you want to change your executor or you want to make a specific bequest, it's going to come out of your residuary estate. It's going to be sort of a less complicated, less expensive change.
But it's not something you want to do every year.
No, but you want to look at them more frequently maybe than people think. Any time that you have a major life change, if you move out of a state, if you have a new child, if you get divorced, if your spouse dies, anything like that would be a reason for revisiting your documents.
What are some of the most common contested parts of the will if it wasn't drawn up properly?
Most common. Well, everybody's fighting about the stuff, right? They want the stuff. Sometimes people have, you know, there's an immediate disagreement about what's supposed to happen with the body. That's happened, but most often what you see is who gets the stuff. And then sadly, you know, stories of, well, you know, my sister went and moved in with mom, and then all of a sudden mom's will changed and my sister's gotten everything. And so you have questions about people. Elder abuse is a big societal concern right now, especially because people are getting older and a lot of the wealth in this country is theirs, so people are fighting over it. There's one behind you.
Again, I want to thank my dad. But when he prepared his will and all these documents, he shared them with all the people who would inherit from his estate. And so if there was anyone who was unhappy with that, they had to make their case with him at that time. And he did make some tweaks as a result of what some people said to him. But I really appreciated that. So when death came, there were no surprises. There was no one who could claim they were being treated unfairly.
Yeah, it's a good thing to do. Yeah, people do some stuff in their will. I don't know.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you so much for, you know, talking to us today,
yeah.
Going through your points. It's great housekeeping stuff that we really need to attend to as we age out, which there are multiple of us here in the room. For a further discussion, all right, as the only person who's aging out in the room, you know, the whole purpose kind of, I think, of this series is for us to help ourselves die with a peaceful mind from the Buddhist perspective. So one of today's things that leaves me with a lot of questions and maybe can be something that we could look to for, and this isn't on you, Margie, but just for the group, that we could look to for a further discussion or another afternoon is the example that Marina gave, because it sounded so stressful and there's a lot of unanswered questions. You know, maybe we can look for somebody who's familiar with like hospital procedure so that we could understand what might be something that we get ourselves into, and the people around us going to be extremely stressed, which is going to then contribute to our peaceful state of mind. Because there sounds like there's a lot of gray area here. Not that anybody who would come would be able to give us all the answers, but to kind of start a discussion about, you know, how we would handle something like that happened. I'm so sorry that happened, Marina, but it's not out of the realm that this might happen to us and cause tremendous stress.
Yeah.
Just something.
I agree that should happen, and Sarah will say something about it. What? I had something. Go ahead, Sarah. I had something about it. Go ahead, Sarah.
So the last session that we were supposed to have was supposed to be all about working with the medical community, and it had to be canceled at the last minute because the speaker was sick. So the next two sessions of this were supposed to continue with legal issues, and Margie and I talked about it and felt like there wasn't enough to have two more sessions on legal issues. So I'm trying to reschedule the medical community one, and that would probably be the last in this series.
I remembered what I was going to say as you were talking about these advanced directive type documents. It's I know people come through the office and sign these things, and they're very clear about who they want to do these. But I don't know how many of these people discuss their fiduciary selections with the fiduciaries they've selected. I don't know how often that happens, or how often people give copies of these documents. You need to do that, which is, to Joanne's point, it's good to discuss this with your family.
A big thing in the retirement community set when my mother was in there is to have all this on your refrigerator, and they even had a sign, some saying of, you know, take this to the hospital with me when I go, kind of thing.
Yeah. I want to say, I think that, unless you had something, Patrick, I am going to offer something on charitable giving on this, and then we also have an FDC person here. This is a wonderful opportunity, and I've had many occasions for which I'm grateful to work with people who make charitable bequests in their documents. You have to have a will to do that. You can amend an existing will to add a charitable bequest. You know, if you're up here and you have a taxable estate, you know, it becomes part of your tax planning. But for most people, you know, they want to leave something, and this would be the right place to do it. And I think Susan can talk about what Kadampa Center has put together to help facilitate that, if anybody would like to do that. And if anybody has, okay, I may have said like five things today that weren't right. So please see a lawyer if you want to do any planning, or, you know, if you're going to, you know, generate your own documents. But if you have any questions, you're welcome to ask me anytime.
Mark,
yeah.
I just wanted to say about the, from my experience with the healthcare power of attorney with my brother and his things, is that that it's important to both to get the document and then also to engage, be sort of proactive in with each medical institution,
yeah,
to sort of find out, you know, what, how most of them in Missouri, he's in Missouri, and most of them now are sort of have that something they look for along with the list of medications and so on, or the medical records.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, it's also sort of, it depends on the time of day as to, and who's, you know, as to whether mm-hmm. the person who's giving care is familiar with those documents and whether they look at the power of attorney and that stuff, let alone the list of medications and sort of the history.
Yeah.
That the medical, the healthcare system really is fractured, and so that you sort of expect when you do all these things that everything's going to be coordinated, and I've expressed my wishes, and everyone's going to sort of take those into account, but you have to sort of really work hard to make that happen.
Yeah, well, I agree. I see it, the individuals see it, medical professionals see it, and it's across the country. It's the same thing. It's a huge problem, but people are working on it. So everybody's aware that it's not working. All right.
Well, should Sarah talk about Dharma wills first? I mean, that might even cover everything I'm going to say.
No, it'll be a bit different.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, just, this is okay. Just in the past couple of years, there have been people at the center who wanted to address this kind of thing for charitable giving to Kadampa Center. And we've had, we're at a point where we have created, or we've created one fund. We haven't really launched this publicly, but we've created a fund, an investment account, so that people can specifically mention Kadampa Center in their will. And then we have everything lined up to create an endowment as well. The minimum for this endowment is $10,000, and nobody's bequeathed that up to this point. So whenever the first person donates or bequeaths $10,000, then we'll have an endowment as well. The difference in these two funds is our investment account, which we're, the working name of this fund is Seeds for Compassion and Wisdom. We may end up changing that, but at this point, that's the name of that fund, is an investment account. It's set up at the Vanguard mutual fund family, specifically invested in the Wellington Fund, and the board has approved all of this. This recommendations were made, and then the board specifically spent quite a bit of time scrubbing this and discussing. So that fund is invested. There was quite a bit of discussion around protecting that fund and making sure that no rogue players could access it. Right now, the way it's set up is the center director and the spiritual program coordinator are the only two people who can access that fund, and that's only after 2/3 of the board agrees to withdraw funds for an expenditure. The intention of that fund, the intention of both funds actually, is to is for growth or some kind of growth capacity for the center, like a new building. It's not for everyday operating expenses or petty cash, that kind of thing. So those safeguards are in place. The difference in these two funds is that the Seeds for Compassion and Wisdom Fund, if that's the name that stays with it, would be available, as I said, the board could withdraw the for a new building or whatever. The endowment fund, the way endowments are set up is that only a percentage of that fund is made available every year for the organization. And so that is a fund that would, sort of the phrase is live in perpetuity.
So that the Kadampa Center actually doesn't own that fund. The investment manager owns the fund with their intention of donating the money over a percentage over every year. We've set up some legacy situations, so in case in the unfortunate event that the Kadampa Center would cease to exist one day, any monies in either of these funds would go to the FPMT and then Sarah J. University. So we've tried to have some legacy planning in the event that, for whatever reason, the Kadampa Center didn't continue to exist. So are there any questions about... So the I didn't bring any sample language. Margie has recommended that as people talk to their estate planners or their attorneys or financial advisors that the language be crafted there. It isn't difficult language. I give or bequeath X percent of my estate or the residual or whatever you all want to work out to the Kadampa Center. Specifically, though, we do need to identify the Kadampa Center as the Kadampa Center that's at 5412 Etta Burke Court, Raleigh, North Carolina, just to make sure that there's no confusion that it's some other Kadampa Center. And it's nice to notify the organization, or if you list other charities in your will, notify them that they are mentioned in the will so that they can be ready to accept a gift. Yes, sir.
And so you can direct it directly to that specific fund?
Yes. Yes, you can mention specific. Yes, in fact, if you wanted specifically to mention that it go into that your gift go into the endowment or Seeds for Compassion and Wisdom, which is a less restricted type situation, or some percent to each. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, let's meet halfway.
So my understanding is that if we wanted to dissolve, I guess that's the right word, the investment account, and if the board decided they wanted to do that, they have the power to do that. Is that correct? I mean, and Robbie, the spiritual SPC and the center director would have access to that account. But the endowment account, all the principal that goes into that stays there. I mean, we can never get that back out again.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
With an endowment, you never get all of the principal out. Right. It's just some percentage, typically 4%, gets paid over. And so in our case, I mean, $100,000 into the endowment would generate $4,000 a year. I think it's typically thought that that kind of money would be paid out every year towards the operating budget, whereas if we build up the Seeds for Compassion and Wisdom, $75,000 or $150,000 or whatever, and we're ready for a new building, that could all be accessed for a new building. There have been occasions when some monies from an endowed fund for unusual circumstances, they may have allowed some small drawdown on the principal. For instance, we're aware of an organization, their roof of their building was blown off in a tornado. They applied to their endowment. The endowment said, yes, you can have, you know, $20,000 out of this $400,000 endowment for a new roof. But it's, you know, yeah. Yes, sir.
If the Raleigh Kadampa Center were ever to dissolve, the endowment would then pass to the international? Yeah. Okay.
And then Sarah J. Right.
First and then second for percentage funds.
First and then second. Right. Yes, ma'am.
You talked about growth and operating expenses as the two places that money can go. What about someone giving the money for a specific purpose? Could be an ongoing purpose, could be whatever. can that be designated, and has there been any talk about how that would be handled?
Yes, you can do anything that you want. And if somebody made a unique, specific bequest like that, and it doesn't have to be in their will. People have given money that they highlight and they put a little circle around it, said, we only want this spent on X thing. It would just be handled at the office level. I mean, that money might not get integrated into either one of these accounts. Yeah, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Who on the SDC does somebody go to talk about leaving planned giving like this? Is there someone?
I think that's me. We're just starting this, and so I think that because I don't have a handout, we do want to put a brochure together, but we've been cautioned by our council, not officially, but just not to be too specific, because we don't want to give anything to somebody that they just didn't write in the margin of their will, thinking that it's either right or causes a problem with their children or estate further. So we really want to make it known sort of what we've done in the background to be responsible for this, and what we have in place without actually doing anything on paper, I guess. Well, we've got on the brochure, it'll have some general specific language, but we're not trying to help, like, say exactly what needs to be done. We've got these things in the background. We can receive it, but we're really not showing you, like, exactly what to do.
That's what your attorney would do.
That's right. That's right.
So everything takes time, and I understand where you're coming from. In the meantime, if I drop dead tomorrow, should my kids talk to you? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Or Donna. I mean, anybody, yeah. So, yeah. It's scary, isn't it? I know. My stomach is in knots after hearing all this, and I thought we were in pretty good shape. But it's like, I will say from personal experience about wills, my parents had tried, and both of my parents died at home, so that worked pretty smoothly. But my parents had, in their wills, tried to set aside a small amount of their assets for my sisters and my retirement, which they wrote each in their wills that this small amount of assets should go into a trust for my sister and myself. And so my father put that in his, and my mother put that in hers as well. So then when my father passed away first, I don't know what made us think this, but I asked a CPA who knows about estate planning to read my mother's will at that point. And so because their language had been identical, it looked like the small amount of assets was going to also have to be set aside from her will as well. And that was not their original intention. It was whichever one died first, some assets from that one's stuff would go to be set aside for this retirement account, because the language was the same. Had we not corrected that when my mother passed away, then assets from her will would have also been set aside. Wasn't the plan. So we ended up quickly after we discovered this having my mother do another will, which then looked different from their original will. And I had read it two or three times just to see, and I had not really put that together. So it's good to even, have somebody review it with sort of a third eye, because you never know.
Yeah, I just want to say, from what I see, those things happen, which is really one of that is the advantage of an attorney over forms, because the forms can generate the documents, but if they don't do exactly what you intend them to do,
you're not either going to be have the capacity to change it because you're incapacitated, or you're going to be dead and you won't be able to do anything about it. That's why it's really important to make sure they're done right.
All done?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, Margie. Hugely helpful. I'm going to pass around some handouts for everyone. There's two different little packets, if you would all like to take one. So earlier in the series, the first section was about Buddhist views of death, the death process. And so if you weren't able to come to those, just the short essence of that is that prayers and practices at the time of death are critical, because that's when your karma determines your next life. And there's extensive books and materials, especially by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, about which practices are most beneficial. We've talked about what's the legal side of taking care of your mind at the time of death. Certainly having all that in place is going to make your mind calmer at death. They highly recommend that you be in the mindset of being ready to just give everything away and not be holding on to your money and your possessions at the time of death, that you'll have a much happier mind if you've done all this already. So that's all really important. But so is knowing what kinds of practices to be done at the time of your death. So in addition to reading the materials that are available, we've set up a page on Kanapa Center's website in the members section that's all about death and dying. It has links to documents. It has important points about everything that's been touched on over this whole year of this series. So that's always available to you. If you're not sure what to do, you can't remember, you want to print out a document, please check that out. And then if you don't find what you need there, please email me and I'm happy to help. And so these are two documents that are available online. One is called The Spiritual Needs at the Time of Death. And, you know, we owe a lot to our former chaplain, Emily Painter, who did just a tremendous amount of work creating this awareness of death and dying, how important it is to learn about all these aspects of it, creating documents for our community, and then I was really honored to be a part of her actual passing herself. And it really sunk in for me how important this is, because she was at home. She died at home in hospice. When it was clear that she was dying, people were constantly going over and doing the prayers that she requested. So she felt, I think, very supported that our spiritual community was there doing the practices she needed done. When she actually, what the Westerner science would say, when she actually died, but Buddhists would say her mind was still continuing, we were going over 24 hours a day saying prayers. And I think it really was an amazing experience for everyone. So this spiritual needs at the time of death is Kadampa Center's form that you can fill out to help us if you're in that situation where you want the support of your community, who can help us interact with your family, because, you know, your family may or may not be Buddhist. We have to get a feeling for how should we approach your family and how do they feel about our being there for you. You know, it may be that we're doing these things all from a distance, or we might be actually coming to your home. All that information is really helpful for us to know as much as we can. So this form really is a way to inform us about all of that and request help from Kadampa Center. And so if you fill this out and give it to me, then it goes into a private file here at the center, and should the need arise, then we can get it and help. And again, this is also something that you could revise at any time. In addition, I printed out the one that says, "Before I Die on My Deathbed." And this is nicknamed a Dharma Will, printed by the Amitabha Hospice, which is another FPMT organization. And this is a really lovely template to make you aware of all of the practices that can be done. It's one of those things that you could just literally go through and circle, check, X, mark, whatever you want to be done. So it really saves you a lot of thinking and time. And so that's another option. You could even attach that to the spiritual needs time of death form that Kadampa Center came up with, so that we have an even more complete picture of what you would like at the time of death. So, and of course, you can come up with your own too. You can create your own sort of version of the Dharma wheel to incorporate your own commitments and practices. But it's just another way to really think about how to cover not just the legal and practical side, but the spiritual side, and give your mind that support that it would need at the time of death. Are there any questions about that? Yes. Yeah, we have a special file in the office, and it's locked up because it is private information. So,
when you were out of the room, we were talking about that. Can we, if we were single and didn't have a place for people to find our will, can we store our will with this in our own file? Would that be smart, or...
If you're single, you still have to name an executor of your will, right? So you would give your executor a copy of it. It wouldn't really involve Kadampa Center.
I don't know if Kadampa Center does that, but, yeah, you would generally want all your fiduciaries, executors, and whatnot to have a copy and then keep the original. I mean, the law says they'll look for your will where you keep your important papers. That could be in a lockbox.
Yeah, it's a lot to think about. Yeah, make sure your executor knows where it is, has the key to the safe, and all of that information. So that's probably a smarter way to handle. If you were making a bequest to Kadampa Center and you wanted the center to have a copy because you wanted us to know it was coming, that's another thing. But yeah, yeah. Any other questions? All right, then I think that wraps it up for today. Thank you, everyone.